Welcome to the Dramatists Guild's In the Room series. This week's episode features award-winning composer and lyricist Lin-Manuel Miranda from a conversation recorded at the 2013 Dramatists Guild National Conference in Chicago with moderator Larry Dean Harris.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. We are live, and by live, I mean live in Chicago. And live over the internet airwaves via live stream, you are, along with me, very privileged to be in a conversation with Lin-Manuel Miranda. Big thanks to our sponsors, Final Draft. We just had a great session with you a couple hours ago, and we got sort of the backstory, and it's amazing. Who doesn't know all the amazing things this guy has done? In the Heights, did a little polish on West Side Story and Working. And like the most fun show I've seen in a very long time, Bring It On. And you may not know, he is the secret weapon behind the Tony Awards. All those fun numbers that everybody raves about how great Neil Patrick Harris is. This man, doing it on the fly.
A lot of help.
Every time I watch, I'm like, how did you do that? So you're going to tell us today.
Sure.
All right, cool. We're going to start at...
This vodka's amazing.
We're going to start in the middle. We know where you came from. I want to know, what are you doing now? What's got you on fire?
Right now?
Besides this.
Illuminati's deep dish pizza has me on fire right now here in Chicago. But I'm pretty single-mindedly working on this Hamilton musical that I've been working on for about 4 years now. I've been writing it since I was still in Heights, writing backstage when I read this amazing biography by Ron Chernow about the guy on the $10 bill, and just fell in love. It just, his life story resonated with so many of the things I wanted to write about. And it was this sort of side of history I really knew nothing about. I knew he got shot by the vice president, but I mean, you know, Dick Cheney shot a guy while he was vice president. Like, that's a thing. That's nothing new. But I fell in love with his story, and I've been working on it for the past 4 years, and we just did a reading up at New York Stage and Film at Vassar, and sort of presented what we had, which was one act and three songs in Act Two. There are 30 songs in Act One. It's become a sung through and rapped through show, and so that's my life right now.
If you don't mind me delving,
yeah.
What's the conceit? How are you taking history and putting it in a contemporary form?
Without giving too much away, I'm just doing what everyone else who writes musicals is doing. I'm finding a musical vocabulary to tell this story. For me, hip hop seems like the only way to tell Alexander Hamilton's story because he is he is the. I know you think that's funny. I really don't. Because it's a story about words, and it's a story about using words to save your life and destroy your life. This is a guy who pulled himself out of his circumstances because he wrote a poem about a hurricane that had decimated St. Croix, where he was living. He was 14 years old. He wanted to be anywhere but where he was. He wrote a letter to a friend. The first letter we have from Hamilton says, I know I am said to be building sandcastles in the air, but we have seen such schemes successful when the projector is constant. I will conclude by saying that I wish there was a war. This is an intense 14-year-old. And this hurricane destroys the island, and he writes a poem about the damage. And the poem gets used as a way to raise money for relief funds. And people take up a collection to send him to the mainland to get his education, because he's all self-taught. He's reading what he can, where he can. He out-Dickenses any Dickens character you know. And he makes himself indispensable to George Washington because he can write really quickly in English and in French, and becomes Washington's aide-de-camp, All the while, he's lugging books through the Revolutionary War, boning up on monetary history because he knows we're going to need it because the currency we made up is worthless and we're losing because British troops, Americans are helping British troops over the revolution because their money means something and ours doesn't. This fear of chaos and basically makes himself indispensable to Washington. He also thinks he's the smartest guy in every room he's in. So he makes enemies of pretty much everybody else. So there's the Constitutional Congress, right? And we're deciding what kind of government we want to have. Hamilton says, this plan is great, and if this is the plan, that's fine. But I have my own idea, and it's five houses of government, and holds forth for 6 hours his own version of what the American government should look like. Half the room goes, this kid is a genius. Half the room, Ben Franklin sitting in there somewhere going, who is this? And so we see him sort of make and destroy his career by his own sort of strength of speech and strength of character.
Cool.
And that to me is Tupac. Yeah. It's this just relentless torrent of words, some of which are incredible, but also this massive contradiction. Some of his songs are, you know, a beautiful ode to his mother, like Dear Mama. Then the next one will be Hit 'Em Up, where he takes out every other rapper working, saying, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. And these contradictions are all in Hamilton, too.
Sounds amazing. I can't wait. Now, you're driving this. Do you have co-conspirators?
I do. I have been working with Tommy Cahill, who directed In the Heights. And, you know, I was working very much by myself, and I was writing at the frantic pace of a song a year. And Tommy heard, I played Tommy what I had written so far, and he said, there's no reason you shouldn't be writing this faster. And like we did on Heights, we started just setting these deadlines. And it's been a very weird road with Hamilton because we kind of showed everyone the ultrasound before there was any hint of a baby. Like in the top of the first trimester, you know, I performed the first song from the show at the White House, and that's become its own viral YouTube thing. That was the only thing I had written. And that was the first public performance of it. But the White House called and said, we're doing this evening of spoken word poetry. You can do something from In the Heights if you want, but do you have anything on the American experience? And I had a hot 16 about Hamilton. That was all I had. And I just felt like, well, what better place to debut something that's about this country? And so, you know, that went viral in its own way. I've talked to lots of teachers who use that in their classroom and to prep them for their American history seminars. And I just want to say, wait, that's just the first song in the show. I've just been doing my best to sort of finish it. And so we, you know, New York Stage and Film was one benchmark, and we're continuing to set deadlines so that we have a show hopefully by next year.
Nice. Now, did you put that out there to light a fire to say, I'm doing this and it's out in the world now and now I have to finish it?
I honestly, a couple of weird, yes, in one sense, but I didn't know, for instance, that HBO filmed that evening. They were following two of their poets who were also performing, and that's why that footage looks like it's out of some surreal movie about my life, as opposed to just like stock footage of a White House performance. It's HBO edited and put it together and put it online. I didn't know that was going to happen going in. I just knew that I think the president will like this. And I didn't know anything else sort of going in. So that was all sort of a happy accident. But yes, I very much need deadlines to write. And with this one, the deadlines have all been weirdly public, which is scary, you know, because people have known about it a long time, and you know, you want to live up to that. But at the same time, it's just the way this one is. You know, some pregnancies are difficult. Some pregnancies are like, oh, I'm in my third trimester, and I just found out I was pregnant. And this one's just been really. I started showing really early, and that's just what it is. So you kind of have to go with it.
I don't think we've talked about collaboration a lot. You obviously have some people you trust. How did you find them? When did you know?
I was very lucky to find Tommy Cahill early in my career, at the dawn of my career, really. So I started writing Heights as a... Most people know this, so I'm going to say it quick. But I started writing Heights as a project in school, in college. And... I had a recording of that and a script. And two kids who were seniors at the time, Neil Stewart and John Mailer, Norman Mailer's youngest son, saw that show and were committed to starting their own theater company when they moved to New York, which was going to be that year. I went on and I put In the Heights in a drawer and kept writing and acting and stuff through college. And they started that company with Tommy Kail. So Tommy had 2 years of listening to my college version of In the Heights on his own and making notes, and he was aware of it before I was aware of him. And true to their word, the week I graduated, they got in touch with me and said, we're still interested in Heights. You know, happy graduation. Come meet us. We've built a... we're building a black box theater in the basement of the drama bookshop. The Arthur Seeland Theater, which is down there, was a storeroom. And they basically said, hey, we'll turn this into a theater, and you can have all the money from it if we can have a clubhouse, which was very smart of them. And so I was in there when it was still just a storeroom. And Tommy, with 2 years of wanting to talk to me, but I don't know why he didn't talk to me, sort of said, Usnavi's an interesting character, but he's only in two scenes. He could be your narrator because all the stories go through his store. In Washington Heights is a really cool song, but it's third. It should be first. It establishes your world. And sort of hit me with where... And, again, this is where time is your friend and everything has to happen at the right time. If he had said that to me after my sophomore year, after having just seen it, I would have said, this is a crazy person. And I think I've written the best thing possible, because at that point in my life, I'd sort of put everything I know into it. When he came at me with all his ideas, I said, one, this guy is really smart and all of his ideas would make this show better. And two, I had 2 years of distance and perspective. And I'm sure you have all learned this, but there is the thing of when you let someone in to see your work and when you let someone say it, because you let them in too soon and they say something and that kind of kills the thing. It's really to be protected. And I had the benefit of 2 years distance on the show. It had been sitting in a drawer. And so I was really ready to hear any and all ideas on how to make it better. And then I knew this guy was the guy to get me there. And that conversation that started the week after I graduated continued another 6 years. And as we worked through the show. And again, you know, we were very lucky to find producers that take chances on new work. Kevin and Jeffrey have sort of made a career out of finding the Jonathan Larsons and Bobby Lopez and Jeff Marxes of the world who have, you know, they're untested, but they have a good idea and they're willing to work hard and getting behind that. And they found us. And Tommy proving himself every step of the way, because, you know, a lot of times you'll be paired with a more experienced director. And Tommy just kept proving himself every time he had the chance to direct a piece. So he came along with the work because he added value to it. He was really an unofficial dramaturg. And when Chiara came on board in 2004, helped us all triangulate and, you know, did the thing that you hear John Kander and Fred Ebb say about Hal Prince when he's directing their shows. You talk and you talk and you talk until you're all writing the same show. And that's when musicals go off the rails, when the music and the story don't necessarily match, or, you know, this person wanted to write this and they've made a Frankenstein instead of a beautiful thing. Tommy's really good at that. And so he's been a really indispensable ally in that respect.
Nice. Now, when you were working it through and developing, I'm sure that these producers weren't the only opportunity.
No.
Who did you have to say no? Not naming names, but tell me about saying no to somebody that you were like, "This is the biggest mistake," or "I know I'm even though everybody's telling me it's the biggest mistake, I know I'm."
Yeah, I could name producers that you know who said, you know. It's a really strong musical vocabulary, but we got to up the stakes. And up the stakes, if you're dealing with Latino show, is make Nina pregnant or involve a drug, some kind of drug plot. Because that's what the producers who were talking to me see on the news when they hear about Washington Heights. They don't hear the good stories that come from Washington Heights. They hear about the bad stuff on the crime blotter. Not only producers, but composers who saw the work would say the exact same thing. Where are the stakes? Where are the drugs? Where's the crime? Which no one says to Woody Allen when he's doing his New York. I've been mugged once, and it was on the Upper East Side in Woody Allen's New York. So I don't know what that's about. Well, I know exactly what it's about. You know, what Kevin and Jeffrey are really good about doing is saying, write the best version of your show, and this is what doesn't work for us. But they're very rarely prescriptive. They don't say, you need a prostitute. They don't say, you need this in Act Two. What they say is, this works, this works, this works. This doesn't work, fix it. And then trust us to fix it and make it better and tell us what they think is missing. And it's very collaborative in that sense. And again, Tommy being great about writing the world. And then also finding Kiara, who was writing these beautiful plays about her family and her community in northern Philly. So that was also a really great marriage, because she doesn't shy away from any of the complications of Latino immigrant life in these struggling neighborhoods. But she also finds the beauty and truth of it. And if you're writing from a place of love, you know, writing about this neighborhood, it can be a joyful thing. And that's what I think that's what people take away from the show, is people have this feeling of, I either long for a community like that, or I relate to one of these characters, because somewhere along the line, whether it was me or whether it was a parent or a grandparent, someone sacrificed so I could do better, or I'm killing myself so that my kid can do better. I think that is something any parent or child can relate to, and we deal with various iterations of that story all through the plot of Heights.
Now, was your goal always to be in the show?
No. I always did Usnavi. I did Usnavi in all of the readings and workshops, because it was just the heaviest lifting and it was the most to teach. So it made Tommy's job easier for me to play Usnavi and then charmingly tiptoe around the plot holes or whatever we hadn't solved yet as the writer while we focused on the other actors and getting them sort of involved in the world. The way Tommy put it was like, you'll play Usnavi for now, and we'll get a real actor later. And that's fine. And that's fine, because, you know, as you can see from my manic public energy, that's you know, it works. It works for the character. You know, when we met Kevin and Jeffrey, you know, Kevin, I was still doing book music and lyrics at this point, and it was becoming an operetta, because I know how to solve problems musically. I know how to solve dramatic problems musically. That's my thing that I'm good at. When it becomes dialogue, it's like all efficiency leaves, and I don't have that gift, and Kiara very much has that gift. And so, you know, Kevin has said here's Kevin, producer of Rent, producer of Avenue Q, which is in previews at this point in 2003. And he says, I don't know what this story is, and I don't think you do either, but I love the musical language, and I like you as that guy. And so I sort of fell in the snowball as it rolled down the hill. And I'd always acted and written in equal measure in high school and in college. I'd write a show every year, but I would also act in other people's things, because it just helped my writing. Like, they feed each other. I mean, they're two sides of the same coin. So it wasn't like, you know, getting the stage manager who doesn't want to be on stage and shoving him on stage. I had experience, but it was a very happy accident.
Well, yeah, happy for us. No, I mean. Who's seen In the Heights? Who's seen it three times? All right. One of my beloved childhood experiences you got a chance to get involved with and just refresh it. So much delight to revisit Electric Company.
Oh, yeah.
You've got to talk about that.
Oh, well, sure. I mean, that was great. Like, I mean, I grew up with Electric Company, too, and, you know, in my house, Rita Moreno is a patron saint. So the fact that we got asked, it was not just me, but this hip-hop improv group I'm involved with, we were sort of involved in the creation of the first test pilot. And then we weren't as involved as the show became what it is and moved forward, the revamped Electric Company. But we still got called on to write songs. Bill Sherman, who did the... co-orchestrations for In the Heights was the musical director. So he would call and say, we need four songs. There's a rap about hard G and soft G, a song about silent E, and they're a joy to write. And now he's a music director at Sesame Street. So, you know, I write a song or two a year when Bill calls me and says, Grover has to rap about being friends. And so he calls me, and it is a joy. The best thing, and this is like one of those things that unexpected gifts that happen because of the circumstances, when you write for Sesame Street, they send you this PDF that is the vocal ranges of all of the Muppets. So, like, Grover can't sing above a D and can't sing below a middle C, whereas, you know, Big Bird has this range, and you can't write one note outside of that range. And it's super fun to sort of the challenge of, like, man, I got to write for Grover. Anytime those assignments come up, I'm happy to sort of put everything to the side and write them.
Would you give us a little demo, maybe?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to think of one that was the piano here. Oh. But there's a Silent E as a Ninja is the one I wrote the fastest, and that is the one that most people's kids know. And it's about the fact that E E jumps on the ends of words and changes the pronunciation. It was like, Silent E is a ninja. Silent E is a ninja. I didn't notice when he came. I cannot accept any praise or blame. And then it just like goes on to like all these words, and then like the E comes in, changes the meaning, that gets like escapes. So that's that. For some reason, I was walking my dog in the park about a month ago, and this kid started following me. This like 13-year-old kid, and I finally stopped and said hi, and he said, "Silent E is a ninja." And I went, "Where'd he go? Where'd he go?" And he was like, "Where'd he go?" And walked the other way. It was great. It was great.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this episode of In the Room with Lin-Manuel Miranda. Join us next time for another episode of the Dramatists Guild's In the Room series.